a tough question for the churches today. Is some Christian doctrine being used to justify domestic violence?
The teaching in some instances of headship and submission within Christian marriages can, I think, be misconstrued such that an abusive person might use that almost as a weapon.
Hello, welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West with you. In a moment, a leading Christian organisation calls for an inquiry into domestic abuse in church communities. And in New South Wales, the Premier and the opposition leader put a tough election campaign on hold to reveal how their faith shapes their policies. He's the highest ranked figure in the Catholic world to be charged with concealing sexual abuse. New South Wales authorities have laid a single charge against the Adelaide Archbishop Philip Wilson. Back in 1976, when he was a junior priest in the Hunter Valley, he allegedly failed to report child sexual abuse by another priest, James Fletcher. Archbishop Wilson has strongly denied the charges. He says he will defend his innocence in court next month. But he's taken indefinite leave from his post in Adelaide. Chris Geraghty is a former Catholic priest who knows Philip Wilson. He left the priesthood to become a lawyer and then a district court judge in New South Wales. Chris Geraghty explains the significance of the charge.
It's a big blow to the Catholic Church. He's an archbishop, and if he has committed this offence even years ago, then like everybody else, he needs to come before the law. That's what the rule of law means.
I mean, he's said to be the most senior Catholic official in the world to be charged with an offence like this. This is, you know, the offence of allegedly failing to report a paedophile offence.
Well,
is that true?
Being an archbishop, yes, that'd be true. Mm. There is a case in America in Kansas City of a person called Bishop Robert Flynn, and he was charged with protecting a priest who had hundreds of pornographic photos. He was found guilty and he was sentenced to 2 years of court-supervised probation. Mm.
Yes, now, Bishop Finn in Kansas City, Missouri, he, as I understand it, is still a member of the Catholic Bishops' Conference. He was placed on a 2-year good behaviour bond. So conceivably, if Archbishop Wilson is found guilty, not given a custodial sentence, could he conceivably continue as a Catholic bishop?
Yes, I think probably he could in these circumstances. Now, you want to go into those circumstances. He was a young priest, as he said, when this offence occurred, if it did occur. And it's a long time ago, 1976.
Yes, although the reality is, though, Chris, from a public position, it would be impossible for him to remain as the Archbishop of a Catholic diocese with this hanging over his head if he is convicted.
Well, if he's convicted, he'll have a criminal conviction against his name. I think that probably would be impossible for him to continue as the Archbishop.
Yeah. What is the specific legal status here? Because Archbishop Wilson is alleged to have not reported a conversation about the paedophile priest James Fletcher back in the 70s. That's not the same as actively concealing a crime, though, is it?
Well, as I understand it, the law requires him under Section 316 of the Crimes Act to inform, to disclose to the police or to the civil authorities if he knows that a child has been interfered with. Now, that's an obligation that he has, not to conceal. The obligation is a positive obligation. Once he knows the information, then he has to share it with the police. Mm. There are defences to that. I understand that one of the defences is if you can persuade the court, the jury, that you have a reasonable excuse for not having approached the police. If the basic allegation is established, then he might have an excuse for not having done it. But he's saying it didn't happen.
Yes, he is categorically denying it. We should say that. I think you've said, though, that he was unlucky in the sense that this offence is alleged to have occurred in New South Wales and the law was different there. I mean,
he's very unlucky because from my reading of what's been going on at the Royal Commission, there are many bishops and probably many senior priests who knew that this was going on. It would seem they knew what was going on in Newcastle too, and they didn't report it to the police. Now, Philip Wilson, if he'd committed this offence, had committed it in New South Wales, and New South Wales is the only state which has 316 of the Crimes Act, which puts a positive obligation on a priest once he finds out about the offence of going to the police. Victoria, Queensland, South Australia, Western Australia, they don't have that offence. One of the reasons why I understand the other states don't have it is because it is just assumed that they have the obligation anyway, and they don't really want to put it as a crime. It's just that if you know the child's being interfered with, then you're obliged to take steps.
The paradox here with Archbishop Philip Wilson is that he seemed to get quite positive reviews in the Royal Commission for his role as bishop in Wollongong in the 1990s, where he was referred to as the healing bishop. So, I mean, there is a paradox.
Andrew, what you have to remember about this is that Philip Wilson was born in 1950. He was ordained in 1975. This offence is alleged to have occurred in 1976. He'd spent 8 years in the seminary and as a tan, walking around talking theology and living in a Alice in Wonderland kind of land, and he's landed as a junior priest, just a little bit above an altar boy in Maitland, and somebody comes along and discloses this to him, if it happened, and what's he going to do? He's at the bottom of the pecking order, there's a bishop in charge, there's vicar generals, there's senior priests. The priest that's actually being complained about is senior to him, and he's a high-profile kind of priest. So this is the situation he was in 1976. Then he became a bishop in Wollongong in 1996 and inherited some fairly bad situations down there, which he dealt with, people say, beautifully. The John Nestor situation, for example, was one where John Nestor was found guilty, indecent assault, I think it was, and it was overturned the next year, 1997, I think, by the district court. But the bishop had other information.
This was Bishop Wilson.
And he just refused to reinstate him. And Rome insisted that he should reinstate him. And he held out against that, against Rome, and said he wasn't going to do it. And then in the end, Rome laicized John Nestor.
Chris, you were a judge for many years. You would also have dealt with many victims, though. They're not going to get much comfort out of the idea that Philip Wilson was a young, naive priest under a lot of pressure at the bottom of the pecking order, though, are they?
No, they're not. They're not. And look, the system had an obligation of training Philip Wilson so that he knew what he was supposed to do in these situations. He went through a very, very bad seminary training, as did I. I had someone disclosing to me in early 1970, one of the students in the seminary. All I was thinking about was mortal sin and confession, and I had no idea about it being a crime and going to the police or anything like that. Now, I must say this person was 18 at the time.
What was the culture in the 1970s that may have contributed to the alleged actions of Philip Wilson as a young priest, of a culture of fear, a culture of keeping it in-house? I mean,
it
was
a culture of clericalism, really, protecting the reputation of the church. There's a very sad story of a senior priest in Sydney who, among his peers, said, "I'd commit perjury to protect the good name of the church." And one of his mates then whispered under his breath, "It might be better if you committed adultery." The culture was clericalism, of protecting the club, protecting your mates. Army does that, parliamentarians do it, any big institution does it, and the Catholic Church was a big institution, and they didn't want this bad name. Of course they didn't, and Philip would have been part of this clerical system. But Andrew, I was a young priest like Philip was. We lived in the Catholic Church. We didn't live in the secular community. We were talking a completely different language. We were living in a different world. And I didn't think of the courts. I'd never been into a court. I'd never been into a solicitor's office. I'd never spoken to a barrister. Those things were just completely out of my mind.
And the great irony was you did, as I say, become a very distinguished judge. Look, Chris, just finally, other people looking at this case, what will they be thinking? What will they be fearing?
Well, if Philip Wilson's getting charged, there'll be others, I would think, going to be charged too, and they'd be running for cover, worried about what's going to happen. He's a very senior member of the clergy in Australia. He's now going to be standing up in court.
And he won't be addressed as Your Grace, will he?
He'll be addressed as the accused. Will the accused please stand up?
The former Catholic priest and New South Wales judge, Chris Geraghty. He's also the author of Dancing with the Devil, his memoir. And this is Andrew West with the Religion and Ethics Report. one of Australia's leading Christian groups is posing a very tough question to what it calls conservative evangelical institutions. Is some of your doctrine being used to justify domestic violence? The Centre for Public Christianity in Sydney wants an independent inquiry into spousal abuse within church communities. It wants to know if some ministers are so keen to keep marriages together that they're telling wives to endure abuse. The director of the Centre for Public Christianity is Simon Smart.
The knowledge that we have of this is anecdotal. So we've heard enough stories to think there are occasions where clergy, no doubt with the best of intentions, trying to look after a marriage, hold people together, have given advice that we would now think is completely inappropriate. And so there's a great need, I think, to recognise when this occurs and take appropriate action to train people in ways that we'd be able to handle these very sensitive, difficult issues in a way that's going to be much more protective of the most vulnerable person. And I think the church has always been at its best when it does look after the most vulnerable. It does this very well in lots of ways and across the centuries. And so this is another example of this, where we need to recognise the victims of domestic abuse, children and usually women, are the victims here that we need to protect and to find good ways of doing that. There is some degree of a problem here. Let's find out the extent of it. Let's look at it and take the appropriate action.
Now, in the piece written for the ABC website, The Drum, by your colleagues, John Dixon and Natasha Moore, they say, "We believe conservative evangelical institutions should urgently consider commissioning a study into both the prevalence of domestic violence in our churches and the clergy responses to it." Can I ask why you specified conservative evangelical institutions?
Well, I mean, I think the whole of the church should do this. But because this had come up within the context of a discussion around the emphasis on headship and submission, it's fair to say that the churches that are likely to emphasise those things tend to be the sort of conservative, evangelical, reformed, which cuts across different denominations, of course, you know, Baptist, Presbyterian, Anglican, perhaps. And so we were just saying, if it is a particular, as some people were suggesting, to that emphasis of teaching, then sure, this part of the church, probably along with everyone else, ought to take an interest in a study like this.
I think that the Archbishop of Sydney, Glenn Davies, has said he'd be happy to take part in a cross-denominational inquiry. Would you seek the cooperation of the Catholic Church too? I mean, that's a church with its own issues about women and their role both in marriage and in the church.
The more the merrier. The better this would be, the stronger it would be, the cross-denominational aspect to this. And sure, yeah, the Catholic Church as well. There have been different studies into this type of thing around the world. There was a study by the Methodists in the UK that found, to their alarm, that domestic violence was as prevalent within their church as it was in the community generally. There was some very good action that came out of that study. Another study in North America found that church attendance was a very strong indicator of less domestic violence. So the reality is we don't know what the problem is, so let's find out.
Now, how would this study work? I mean, who's going to do the work? Who's going to undertake it?
Well, I think it needs to be independent. A couple of people have suggested that perhaps in the first instance, an expert panel could look at and analyse the teaching of the church to say, look, let's look at 5 years of sermons on marriage, for instance, and see what's being taught there. Sermons, but also other literature that's coming out of the church, perhaps to identify any problematic areas where there might have been unintentionally a teaching that might foster an environment where an abusive person might take advantage of that, twist it and use it to their...
We're going to come to that because that's critical to this whole enterprise. But, I mean, who are we talking about conducting the inquiry? Social workers, lawyers, people with investigative expertise? I mean, who are you? How are you planning this?
Well, depending on what you do. So if you did that, you'd need people like theologians, you'd need sociologists, you probably need psychologists. So yes, a range of experts who have some knowledge of the area, but also perhaps knowledge of the church. I think that would be worthwhile. If you did a large quantitative study, then that I think would need to be a sort of industry research partnership with a university and probably with government funding. I'd love to see that type of big survey done where you look at domestic violence across the community and then in this case particularly within the church and see what the relationship is.
Simon, I've no doubt there are some cases where naive clergy have counselled women to stay with abusive husbands. I'm wondering, though, whether it's always, as you say, with the best of intentions. There is the example given of a very popular American evangelist, John Piper. Now, he has said that he's knowingly told women to put up with a certain amount of physical abuse. And then when the physical abuse gets too much, consult not the police, but their church. So there are cases where some clergy are not naive about this. They've knowingly made these decisions.
I don't doubt that there are examples that we could bring up of completely regrettable advice. Most people who hear that type of thing would say, no, that's not what we want as the message from the church. We want people to be protecting vulnerable people. And even someone who you might describe in that way as kind of intentionally doing this is still trying to protect marriages. I would say in that case, it's ill-advised. I think what happened in that study in the UK was that in response to the Methodist study, the Anglican Church took up a very strong position on this and had a whole lot of policies implemented that took into regard training for people, you know, red flags, what are things that we need to be looking out for, what are ways in which the church might be contributing to this in a way that didn't intend to, and finding ways of training people such that this doesn't happen. I think that response was a very good one, and it was a multi-pronged response. It was in policies and training and resourcing people. I think we probably are in a situation where we want to think about that.
Now, from the very outset of our discussion, Simon, you talked about this issue of doctrine, of headship. What is the doctrine that is at issue here?
Well, the teaching in some instances of headship and submission within Christian marriages can, I think, be completely misconstrued such that an abusive person might use that almost as a weapon. And we've heard examples of this happening terribly.
Yeah. Well, the columnist Julia Baird, a colleague here at the ABC, but also at the Sydney Morning Herald, as you well know, because the article that your organisation wrote cited that, she spoke of an occasion where a woman was dragged by the hair while her husband quoted biblical passages about obedience.
Yes. Yeah, and to any serious believer, that's a horrifying thought. It's a completely illegitimate use of the Bible. Those passages that talk about headship and submission are in no way justifying that sort of any sort of abusive or domineering behaviour. It's in the complete antithesis of what's at the heart of Christianity, which of course is self-sacrifice, non-violence, and care for others. So I'd want to think about what I think the spirit of those passages is mostly about. And I think it's hardly at all to do with who might be in charge or the boss, and much more, the emphasis to me when I read that material is much more about the husband in this case loving his wife just as Christ loved the church in laying down his life for her. And the sort of dynamic within a Christian marriage as I see it is calling the husband towards deep self-sacrificial love where he's kind of lifting the other person up, truly, and it's not easy to do, but truly putting his own interest second and hers first and trying to lift her up and allowing her to flourish. It's the absolute opposite of the sort of abusive kind of behaviour that we're hearing about in some instances.
Simon Smart of the Centre for Public Christianity here on the Religion and Ethics Report. This is Andrew West. Finally, in the midst of a hard-fought election campaign in New South Wales, and they always are, Liberal Premier Mike Baird and New South Wales opposition leader Luke Foley suspended hostilities for one night. They came together for a forum organised by the Australian Christian Lobby. They discussed how their deeply felt Christian faith shaped their politics. We begin with Mike Baird.
How I apply all of, I guess, my sense of faith in terms of what I do and the operating model I try and apply, it's quite simple. What you need to do is to ensure that you've got a strong economy. The stronger economy you have, you've got more capacity to actually deliver not only services and infrastructure, but most importantly in that overall context, is also look after the vulnerable. Services, infrastructure and vulnerable. And they're the pillars that I've framed my budget on. I have been challenged in terms of taking away the size of the overall public service. I can assure you I've wrestled with that. But you're also trying to look in terms of the long term. There are schemes where you clearly have difficult decisions to make. A victim's compensation scheme is a good example, where you have victims, obviously terrible circumstances. You've got to have the capacity to look after the victims in the long term. At all times, I think that context of trying to be financially responsible, to provide an opportunity for those who need it most, as an operating principle, that's what I've tried to undertake. And I'm not going to pretend I'm perfect, and I'm not going to pretend every decision I've made is right, but I can assure you that I labour over every single one of them. Thirdly, you know, I think the opportunity as a Christian in this role is to see things that naturally would attract you. A couple I give you. Those might have heard of Bear Cottage. It's the only children's hospice, for those who don't know it, here in New South Wales. Indeed, there's only two in the country. Terminally ill kids. There's not only incredible medical support, there is also a range of community groups that link in to provide opportunities for the families that are dealing with these terminally ill kids to have wonderful memories with them. I've had the opportunity to see this sense of youth services. And in a faith context, and as we know, every single person matters. Every single person. And, you know, I've seen some kids who, you know, life would say to them, you're worth nothing. But they do. They have value. And we have unbelievable services across this state that tell them they do. And, you know, I can't think of anything, you know, more important than telling these kids that they do. And if that's your sense, imagine being in a position to come alongside some of these youth services, Youth Off the Streets, St. Vinny's, all of these groups that on a daily basis look after these kids that have no one and have nothing. They're the sort of opportunities that I think make all the difficulties and all the challenges worthwhile. The second last thing I'd say is that it's the word of integrity. You shouldn't speak about integrity. It actually belittles the world to talk about it. I think people want to see his actions, not words. You know, not in a Christian context, not God speak. They want to see you helping people. They want to see you living a life that's distinctive and shows everyone that you really are walking what you believe. The one issue I use there is donations, and you've seen across the political spectrum the donation issue. I've taken actions to try and improve that. Now, have we got it perfect yet? No, we don't. The last is, as I've spoken to people who've been in politics, and I would say it probably applies to many people, what they regret having left is that they didn't take enough risks. I've really thought deeply about this. You know, what does that mean and how does that look? But I think that a life that is taking risks in the context of faith, I don't see that as a risk. The issues and the policies I'm put forward, I'm generally putting them forward because I believe that they will make a difference to the people's lives in this state.
My name's Luke Aquinas Foley. I have to carry that burden. The foundation for me in my public life is that we're all human beings. We're not economic units of production. Every human being is born with an inherent dignity. I've always thought that that shared root of all of our religious traditions, the Golden Rule, consciously supplies a moral compass to humanity. I grew up in a household that was Catholic and Labour. Mum raised my sister and me on her own. Catholic social teaching, I think, could best describe the values that Mum raised us around. The dignity of the worker, a sense of obligation to the poor, the preferential option for the poor. Those were the things that were instilled in my sister and me from a young age. And I'm not going to get party political here tonight beyond saying that I think when Labor's at its best, there's a moral basis to Labor politics. That stems from Rerum Novarum, that papal encyclical of 1891, which has made a huge impression on me about the rights and the duties of capital and labour. The faith tradition I come from teaches that the way societies are organised is a moral matter. One of my concerns today is the strident materialism of contemporary culture. It's driven by a quite militant individualism, that individuals' desire for pleasure trumps all else. I've got a concern, and I want to hear religious voices in the public square talking about the relentless commodification of human beings. The rapaciousness of an unchecked market that relentlessly imposes itself on family and community life. At a press conference yesterday, I was peppered with aggressive questioning as to why I wouldn't support a complete deregulation of trading hours on Boxing Day. I said, well, shop trading hours have liberalised a hell of a lot since I was a kid, and overall I think that's a pretty good thing for our society. People lead busy lives. But can't we have some limits? Retail workers forced to stack shelves on Christmas Day. Can't we draw the line somewhere? There's not many days that are off limits anymore. And, you know, for me, that debate reflects just the almost remorseless nature of an unchecked market. Labor at its best believes in civilizing capitalism, and one of the ways we can do that is to put some boundaries around the impositions on family and community life. So I think Labor's at its best when it thinks about those sorts of issues, the obligations we owe to each other, parental responsibility. I want dads to face up to their responsibility in life and be dads. I lost mine when I was 8, never saw him again. I want dads to hang around, and I want politicians to talk about that. The political environment I'm in and Mike's in derives from the imperfect world we're in. But I do think there's a role for us as political leaders to talk about values, not simply about how we balance budgets. Governing's about the granular detail, but ultimately, we're Democrats, not merely technicians. And my political involvement stems from the values that Mum instilled in me from a very young age, the values that the Labor Party at its best, the Catholic Church at its best, have both helped form me into the person I am today.
New South Wales opposition leader Luke Foley and before him Premier Mike Baird addressing a recent pre-election forum organised by the Australian Christian Lobby. Now, before we go, last week we previewed the Israel elections. That was thought to be a close-run thing. The ABC is reporting that the right-wing Likud leader Benjamin Netanyahu has been re-elected as Prime Minister. The New York Times has observed that the election has turned, in its words, ugly. Mr. Netanyahu reiterated there would never be a Palestinian state on his watch, and then, according to the Times, ranted, quote, right-wing rule is in danger, Arab voters are streaming in huge quantities into the polling stations. So yes, maybe some quite incendiary words there. We'll look at the implications of the election in a future program. But that is all for this week's Religion and Ethics Report. Thanks to producer Scott Spark and technical producer Joe Wallace. I'm Andrew West. Patricia Karvelas is up next with Drive. And Patricia, you have found Australia's best barista.
I have, and we will be interviewing him. We want to get to the bottom of, you know, how he makes these amazing coffees and how I can make sure that I can find him and make him make one for me at about 6 a.m. every day, which is when I like to have my first coffee. Also, France is likely to pass a bill banning super skinny models. They're going to actually fine modelling agencies that have super skinny models. It's quite an extreme reaction to the modelling industry. So we're going to get into that on RN Drive after the news. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yes, and a well-made cappuccino shouldn't make you fat, although I wish I had that advice. All that after 6 on RN.
If you have a smartphone, you can now take RN and a whole host of ABC Radio services with you wherever you go. Listen live with the easy-to-use ABC Radio app, or you can podcast the many RN programs available to listen anytime you wish. So listen live to RN programs right now, or catch up with your favourite RN shows later. The ABC Radio mobile app. Download it from your smartphone's app market.